Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have with me Patricia Monaghan, who is the co-author of Meditation, The Complete Guide, Techniques from East and West to Calm the Mind, Heal the Body, and Enrich the Spirit. Patricia is joining us from Wisconsin today. She has several books on contemporary spirituality, as well as she is a faculty member at the School for New Learning at DePaul University in Chicago. And today we're going to be talking about meditation, which we've talked about many times before on the show, but this particular book I like because it presents meditation from all sorts of viewpoints, including traditional religious viewpoints, scientific viewpoints, and just what I've always said, meditation can be part of your life. Even if you can't sit still and quiet your mind, you can meditate in nature, you can meditate out on the golf course, you can meditate playing piano. There are many, many ways to quiet your mind and allow some spirituality into your life. Welcome, Patricia. Thank you for joining us.
You've done a great synopsis. That's exactly what we were hoping to get across with the book. And thank you for acknowledging that I'm the co-author, Eleanor Virick, who is a scientist and also a yoga teacher with my co-author. And she is guilty of the wonderful chapters on yoga and a number of the others, which were an amazing resource to tap into. She's in her 80s and still practicing yoga.
Well, that's wonderful. Yoga is a great combination of physical and mind techniques. They're married in that discipline, and it's really a good one.
It's a good example of how to think about meditation that is not just sitting still and focusing the mind. Because I think when people limit meditation to just the tradition of, say, Zazen sitting, and they're not very easy about sitting still, and they quit because they say, oh, I can't meditate, they probably tried the wrong form.
Right. That's what I tell people, too. Not everybody can start out, in the traditional sense, whatever way you come to it, of just quieting the mind. But I think most people understand something called contemplation, where you have a very intense focus on one thing, such as looking at a candle or, looking at, for me, it's surgery. Most people can understand contemplation, which is focusing on a single thing. You use the example in the book of the simple one of just focusing on a candle light, which I think is an excellent one. There's other ones that people have, focusing on a particular word, mantra, or subject with laser-like intentness. And in surgery, we attain that state as surgeons because we're focusing entirely on what we're doing. And I've noticed that when I'm in that state, people can come in the room and even try to talk to me, and I'm so focused that I don't even hear them. So contemplation, I think, is something that people can understand.
The concept of flow and being in the moment so fully that it just flows through you.
Right. And that's really what the state you're trying to get into. It's a state in which you can get, information. Information from beyond space and time that can be very helpful to you. It's a space in which you can get, your body in a more healthy state. Conditions can improve or even disappear. And I think that's the state that we're trying to get into when we're seeking any of these disciplines. We're trying to get into a certain state of being to have union with something greater than ourselves that can benefit us in many ways.
That's absolutely true. And I'm glad you used the word contemplation, which I think is a is a really fine word. There is one form of Christian meditation called contemplative reading. And it should be distinguished from rumination. The basis of that word is the cow chewing its cud, where you just kind of chew over things over and over, and you know, you don't really get any further with it. It's not really opening yourself to anything. It's really a closing down kind of obsessive thinking. So in contemplating, you're trying to be open to messages and to information and to new ideas, whether you're contemplating, as you say, with a mantra meditation, repeating a word, or a yantra meditation, studying a sacred image. What you're not doing is obsessing and ruminating. And I think that's a subtle distinction. There's something non-thinking about meditation, and that's a hard state to get into in a society where we really privilege rationality. It's an integrating sort of thing, because it's not that we're not thinking, we're being thoughtless, but we're beyond thinking as well. And contemplation, I think, does capture that. That word does.
And, you know, if you study scientific history, there's a number of examples, Einstein being one, I think the guy that developed the benzene ring, the other. What they do, and I think this is great to do with anything in your life that's problematic. Essentially, you have a problem, so you frame the problem in a way where you ask for help with the problem. And you do so, you know, in an open manner, not thinking you know everything, but thinking that maybe you need to ask for help, higher guidance type thing. And then Einstein used to go to sleep, you know, take a nap and have dreams. I think the benzene ring was a dream also. But when you're in an altered state of consciousness, and that can be through meditation, through dreaming, through whatever, trance state, then often the solution will come to you. And I think that
one of my favorite scientific stories is that one of my favorite scientific stories is that Descartes actually dreamed up the idea of the mind-body split in a dream. And I just think that's so ironic that we've been plagued with this idea of duality ever since because he dreamed it.
Right.
did he not make the connection there?
That's good. I hadn't heard that one. That is good. But, you know, the images coming up from beyond the conscious mind, or, you know, be it subconscious or superconscious, the images coming up often in the dream or in the daydreaming state often can have profound meaning to what you're asking about. And it doesn't really matter if you're trying to find out the structure of the benzene ring or if you're trying to figure out, you know, how to get out of a certain situation in your personal life. The answers will come to you if you just allow them to. I think that's what spirituality is all about, is tapping into other than conscious realms to grow and to energetically change as well.
When we were working on this book, and I should say this is the second edition, the first one came out 11 years ago, and this one has a number of new chapters and lots of added resources and information. When we were first working on it, we had very interesting discussions, my co-author and I, about what was meditation and what was beyond what we would call meditation. We decided, for example, that although massage has a relaxing quality and can put you in greater integration, most people would not consider it meditation. And you usually have to have somebody else do it to you, so it's not something you can practice on your own. So,
right.
You know, we made some distinctions there. But one thing we kept coming around to is that there are some people who want to meditate, but they don't want to be spiritual, which seems to me, eventually I think people wind up becoming more interested in spirituality if they meditate. But some people start with a very anti-spiritual idea, and these are often people who are led to meditation because they're having some health problem, chronic pain, for example, which meditation can be good at relieving. or insomnia. But I think that eventually, if you practice meditation, you will be drawn into interest in spirituality. And I use that broadly, not necessarily interest in a specific religion. We also found that there were some people who were turned off from meditation because of religion rather than spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my process in writing a book and writing a book proposal before we propose it to an editor is to go into bookstores and pretend I'm the audience for my own book. So I was going into bookstores and asking them for a general book on meditation. Then I'd see what they showed me. And I got to this one bookstore in a small, fairly conservative Christian town, and the bookseller leaned across and her eyes narrowed and she said, "You don't want to do that. It's the work of the devil." And that was a surprise to me because I didn't realize that there were people who were being preached at that they should avoid meditation because, you know, they would, you know, begin
get taken over by an evil spirit.
Yeah. So we actually sought out and incorporated forms of Christian meditation in one entire section because there are lots of forms of Christian meditation. One of the ones I particularly cherish is Taizé singing, which is this wonderful tradition from post-war Central Europe. And, you know, these are not going to disturb your religion, you know, your religious ways, but will give you a method that can incorporate them. Just before Christmas, the chief inquisitor at the Vatican announced that yoga should not be practiced by Catholics because it would lead to worshiping Hindu gods. So that is still out there. Some people are still being told that. So we tried to incorporate forms of meditation that would be appropriate for people of all different types of religious backgrounds, non-religious backgrounds, and also purposes for meditation. Some people meditate to enrich their lives rather than to, you know, solve a health problem. We call these the performance people who want to be more inspired in their artwork and so forth. And so we have a whole section on creative meditations. And there are all sorts of ways you can enhance your creativity through meditation. So, but I do think, as to go back to my original point, that no matter where you start from, I think that you grow toward being interested in spirituality. The one form of meditative, a mechanical way of learning the same skills as meditation that we didn't find any evidence would necessarily lead you toward any kind of spirituality was biofeedback. And if somebody is like completely secular, does not want to hear anything about the spirit, but they really want to learn the skills of relaxation, biofeedback can work. One of the demands we made on ourselves was that one or the other of us or both had to actually practice the meditation for a while, so we were writing from the inside. The book is not written in a confessional, I felt this way, but it seems that meditation is an experience. Meditation is not a theory. It's a practice and an experience. So I was the one that drew the short straw on biofeedback, and I want to tell you, I just was terribly uncomfortable. I meditate daily, and I would just stare at those little dials and go down, go down. I found it to be an extremely uncomfortable experience. I wouldn't go back. I did my part for the book, but it was for me actually alienating from the meditative experience. But for some people, it's perfect. It's exactly what they need.
Yeah, and I think that just from a medical standpoint, biofeedback is probably one of the more accepted forms of, if you want to call it, maybe contemplation. But it's more that you're trying to actually get something to occur through, through your mind. But certainly, I've interviewed many, many authors on the benefits of spiritual practices. And there are not too many people on the planet that don't have health challenges of some sort on some
good
occasions,
point.
You know.
Good point. Or will.
So, or will, right. So, but I do think it's interesting you brought up the point that some people who are engaged in creativity, sports, things where they're performance-based, do have a great deal of success in improving their activity through these practices. And I remember I bought a book from my father called The Zen of Golf.
What a great title.
Yeah, it was a great book. Well, you know, golf is a very personal thing. You really don't play against other people so much as you play against your own scores, you know, and your own performance. And, you know, it's a meditation in itself. I was involved in the Kansas Eastern Tournament at one time, so I played, you know, in tournaments, and I felt it was a great meditative. You've got all that green, you know, you've got you usually go out early in the morning, so it's everything's beautiful. And
that's a good example of the kind of activity that could be meditative, or you can turn it into a job.
Mm-hmm.
In our original discussions when we were making our first list of meditations, I adamantly said that crafting was one of my great meditations. I learned to knit when I was 6 from my grandmother, and I still knit. Mm-hmm. I really rely on knitting to get through faculty meetings. It's
right.
A great meditation for me. And Terry, not being a crafter, Terry's the nickname for my co-author, Eleanor, she was not convinced. And as I started looking for books about it, there were practically no books at the time, a few articles. This was only 11 years ago. But I prevailed, and I got to include that chapter. But since then, in the new issue, I found lots of books, The Knitting Sutra, The Zen of Knitting, and so forth. And many more people have discovered that crafting can be a kind of meditative way. However, I can also guarantee that if you are trying to finish that scarf for the nephew's birthday tomorrow and you are, you know, pushing yourself and
you don't stay in the moment.
When you're driving yourself, when it's a driven thing, it is not a meditation.
Right.
It's not centering yourself in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
In an odd way, you can say that meditation is aimless or purposeless activity. The purpose is to be doing it, not to be getting something out of it. It's the paradox at the heart of meditation, that if you're sitting there going, I will relax, I will relax.
not likely
that
to.
That will not get you there.
No. Well, I understand exactly what you mean about the crafting. I got through high school knitting, doing needlepoint. I used to do crocheting of spheres. I used to like to crochet in three dimensions.
I like
a lot of things in three dimensions. And being a surgeon is perfect because, you know, as a plastic surgeon, I have to put somebody's face back together, recreate their nose, you know. Sometimes we'll look at their picture and try to make their face look the way it used to. So it's very much a 3D art form. And I always just spent lots of my time in crafts that were like sculpting, but often with sewing, because my mom was a home ec teacher and I was really into all of those different sewing techniques. So I understand the... I guess I was meditating back then with the...
Yeah, and it is still trying to pay attention to class. I can tell when I have begun to change from, you know, being in a meditative space, and I'm starting to go, you know, I got to finish this, whatever it is. One of the things that I do is I'm a member of Afghans for Afghans, which is a Quaker organization that, you know, we make Afghans and send them to people in Afghanistan. I love the title Afghans for Afghans. You can also make hats and things, and I find making the same Afghan over and over, having the pattern memorized, just, you know, not being in a great hurry. I don't have a deadline to meet. You know, packages go off every few months. I don't feel this compulsion. And I think that getting beyond compulsion, we are a pretty compulsive society. You know, we should do all the time. And that's really the opposite of what you're trying to reach in meditation. In meditation, you're trying to reach the state of being. And that just reminds me of that graffiti I saw in a university restroom once. It said, to be, let's see, what did it say? To be or not to be, Hamlet, to be is the point. Sartre, dooby dooby doo.
Right.
Something like that. I can't remember the rest of it. But really, yeah. You're trying to just get into that present existent moment and not be trying to control things.
Mm-hmm.
Often meditation is not fun, pleasant. It's not deep. It's not profound. It's not really spiritual. I do sitting zazen every morning, and it is one of the harder meditations because the minute your mind is blank, it fills with all sorts of
mm-hmm.
junk. And so I get to see what junk is there. I like to refer to it as the wetlands of the spirit. You know, it might just look like a swamp sometimes, but it's doing its job. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's clearing things out. It's part of the process of integrating somehow. And so
yeah.
without that period of sometimes not very spiritual seeming contemplation, the rest of my life is different. If I'm traveling, and a challenge for me, I travel a lot, and a challenge for me is trying to fit my meditation into hotel rooms and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I try all the time, and I've never quite got the, you know, I have a little traveling altar that I put up and so forth, and
mm-hmm.
I try, but I've never really reached a good pattern for meditating while traveling. I may yet do that. But I notice that I get more challenged by things going wrong and more fretful. The things that I think get sort of eased out with a regular meditation practice, I really miss it if I can't meditate.
Going back
to yoga, too, you know, people are very individual. I've been actually taking yoga once a week for possibly 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, pretty much every week I could skip. I have never loved it. there's just, you know, I do it, but I've never really loved it. But if I go 3 days without my Qigong practice, I get really snarky. I want to go, I love my Qigong practice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends who stayed with me for a while and was doing Qigong with me said, boy, you just get in such a zone. You're just gone, you know. And I am. I there's something about those movements and, you know, the patterning, and I am very, very involved in it. And during yoga, I'm very self-critical, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you think after many years, I would feel at least, you know, I mean, I've gotten better, but I'm still like, God, that lunge is bad. And I somehow can release that with Qigong, and I somehow can't with yoga. That may go back to, you know, the original teachers I had or something. I'm not sure. But yeah. I urge people to try out forms of meditation and try them long enough to see whether they stick without giving
mm-hmm.
up on them. I mean, don't do it twice and go, that didn't work for me. But don't feel like a failure if it's, you know, not your form of meditation, if it's not the thing that, you know, makes you want to. If you don't want to do it every morning, if you avoid your practice, maybe you ought to look for something you want to do.
Right.
Your body-mind will tell you what's right for you. And then when you have found something, you know, stick with it, embrace it, study it fully, find masters, you know, really embrace your practice.
Yeah, the other thing
and
is...
And you may have more than one. I think I practice... Overall, I probably practice 10 meditations, forms of meditation regularly, and then mm-hmm. others sporadically.
Right.
I rarely do sketching in nature in the winter, for example.
right.
On the other hand, I rarely do crafts in the summer. I'm usually gardening. So.
Right. When I was, I took 5 months off from being a plastic surgeon to do nothing but spiritual practices, and one of the things
wow.
I did was meditate about 5 hours a day, and
wow.
every time I sat down, this is kind of a funny story, but I think you'll relate to it, every time I sat down to meditate, something would happen outside. Dogs would start barking, construction, you know, the jackhammers, whatever, but I laughed at it because I knew that was being... That's like a synchronicity in reverse. What's happening is you're being given a challenge, so that you can overcome it. And I wanted to tell the audience, and I think you'll agree, that the purpose of any of these spiritual practices is not while you're doing them so much. It's while you're not doing them that you can maintain a higher energy level, and specifically that you can walk in meditation and keep your mind quiet so that you can have things come in that are important. You know, like if something bad's going to happen, you can get the message to avoid it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're monkey mind and chattering all the time and going over and over and over all the things that bother you, you will walk right into that dangerous situation without the ability to get, you know, to get the messages from beyond our conscious world that things are maybe you shouldn't go into that gas station. I told a story on this show that I was on my way to the emergency room, and I wanted to stop for gas because I knew the guy was in CAT scan and it's going to take a while, and I heard absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not. And so I went on, took care of him, took him to surgery, sewn him up, came back, and there were 7 police cars around that quick trip. And a guy, wife had been taking him to the hospital to get to the psychiatric unit and decided to stop for gas, and he got in the glove compartment, got the gun, and shot, I think 4 or 5 people died, and other people shot. And so, you know, I mean, there are certain circumstances that you don't know about that you're about to walk into, and if I had been really, you know, low energy and kind of grousing that I got called in, and you know how, you know, just cursing the moment that you know, wanted to do something else and had to go to the ER instead, and I hadn't heard absolutely not, you know, these are protective things, and
yeah.
So and they're not just protective, but you know, not doing business with somebody that's going to lead you down a road that is going to end in a lawsuit. You know, not getting romantically involved with somebody who's got some disease that you don't want to get. You know, all these things are, there's a huge amount of information outside of you that would be useful to you. And meditation and other spiritual practices, I feel, is the way that we get that information into our lives.
Yes, very well said. I love your story about the dogs barking as soon as you meditate. I'm a Quaker, and when I first became an active Quaker 40 years ago, there was an old man in Quaker meeting, and he would get up every Sunday, and he would give a book report.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be long and very tedious. And every week, I mean, he would, you know, typically I'm a member of unprogrammed friends meetings, which is you sit in silence and wait for a message to rise from the spirit. Well, the spirit always spoke to him, and it always spoke to him promptly at 11:30, and
right.
He would rise, and he would give his book report. And he was, you know, a very lonely person and, you know, lived in his books and was kind of eccentric. And, you know, so he would speak for 2 minutes or so. But during that 2 minutes, I would rage. You know, I just...
Yeah.
That's not what a message from the spirit should be. This is just your stupid book report you give every... And I realized I was really not getting me anywhere. So
right.
I decided that I would use his speaking as an indication to go into deeper meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while, he would get up and speak, and it would be like this great blossoming. I would be like,
right.
Oh. And then he died.
Oh, no.
And I actually missed him because I thought, wow, who's going to give me the cue? But I think that, you know, that was a great learning for me.
Well, you know, it reminds me of I think it's the first lesson in the Course of Miracles where you look around the room and say, you know, nothing in this room has any meaning unless I give it the meaning. And so you gave his something that irritated you, which Ram Dass would call that seed that needed to be popped. You know, you recognized that was something that you had to work on, and then you used that to change the meaning, which is brilliant. Yeah, that's absolutely great. That's what we're supposed to do with everything that annoys us. Actually.
Yes, exactly. Would that I were able to. That was a
right.
successful experience. They aren't always so.
Yeah, well, yeah, and the other thing, too, a lot of the time when anger comes up or irritation comes up or frustration comes up, it doesn't have to be from that point in time. You know, a lot of times I've had a number of patients who just say they're incredibly raging angry and they have no idea why. I think this anger is coming up from, you know, previous lives, from previous times in this life that we may not remember. You know, think about the anger that you might have when being born, you know, going from a nice, you know, comfortable place and going through
a really bad experience.
You know? Right. You know, you might have had quite a bit of anger at that, and now's the time to release it, you know. So sometimes when things come up, it's just needing to get out. And so getting it out and not re-suppressing it would be the goal. And I think during meditation,
there's so many ways to do it. It's one of the pleasures of reworking this book again after 11 years was to revisit all of the different forms of meditation we had included before, and then you know, look into ones that we had either not known about or simply hadn't included. I cannot explain why in the first edition we didn't have prayer beads. You know, around the world kind of meditative form found in many cultures. And I'm not quite sure why we forgot it the first time around. I have been introducing prayer beads in various ways in work that I do, and suggesting that people make their own related to whatever is, you know, their basic spirituality. So you could do prayer beads for the seasons, or you could do, you know, whatever seems to be appropriate, because the point is that the repetition of a series of sounds connected with a series of movements, in this case moving the beads between your hands, generates a meditative flow.
Right. Yeah,
that's something found in many meditations, the idea of repetition. When you're all endlessly inventing, you know, trying to create something anew each time, and we do live in a world that cherishes the new, then, you know, we don't get that experience of falling into almost a hypnotic trance in a way of the, you know, this repetition does something that, you know, we're repeating words, we're repeating actions. That repetition busies up part of our mind sufficiently to free up another part of our mind. Mm-hmm. And you used the term monkey mind, before, which is a term I just love from Zen. We all know what the monkey mind feels like. There's a kind of tree that grows in Ireland called the monkey puzzle, and it's got these very complicated branches. And whenever I think of the monkey mind, I think of a monkey running around a monkey puzzle tree, getting all knotted up in its branches.
Right. Well, and mantras, you know, I mean, the mantra is across religions, actually.
Yes.
You know, amen in Christianity is sort of the om of Christianity. But the mantra does the same thing. You know, you repeat the mantra, and it can be anything. I mean, it can be anything that you're guided to. And a personal mantra, something you get within, is probably the best one to use. And it does free up part of the mind so that the other part of the mind can do the meditation. That's really true.
At essence, though, it is meditation is doing something. It's doing it, and it's doing it again, and doing it again. And it's practice. Mm-hmm. It's something that you do. It's kind of ironic in a way to write a book about meditation, because reading the book gets you nowhere. It's only in doing the meditation that you get anywhere. We hope that the book gives you cues about what to do. Each chapter gives a sort of little, if you want to try it, you know, follow these, you know, checklists.
At the end, you have
you
that.
You can kind of work your way through and try them in different ways if you'd like.
Right.
But if you're not doing it, then you're not meditating. If you're thinking about meditating, if you're planning to start a class, then you're not meditating. Some people go to classes and find that that gives them the structure to get started, but ultimately you have to be able to find a way to have a practice that you can do yourself. Because if you're relying on, you know, getting the train to downtown to get to the class, et cetera, sometimes that won't happen. And if the only time you're going to do your yoga is that once a week when you're going to, you know, get to class, then that won't be a sufficient practice. There are some meditations that are really occasional. We put in a chapter on pilgrimage, which is one of the great meditations, religious meditations found in many cultures, journeying to a sacred space. And in most cases, that is done occasionally or maybe only once in a lifetime, as in the Ramadan pilgrimage to Mecca. You're not going to make a pilgrimage every day. So there are some forms of meditation that are really occasional meditations rather than ongoing ones. But the predominant aspect of meditation is it's something you do, if not daily, pretty frequently. It's something that is part of your life, and it allows you that space away from the busyness of the rest of your life. If you can get, and everybody can get in 10 minutes a day, and rarely can people get in an hour a day. So it's better to find a form that you can do every day a little bit rather than saying, well, I'm gonna take a yoga workshop every 3 weeks for 4 days. Regularity and consistency is better than occasional intensity. Occasional intensity can kind of boost your practice, but your practice should be something you can maintain by yourself and on a regular basis. And it usually takes people some kind of puttering around to find out what works for them. You know, people may happen into the exact right meditation for them on the first go-round, but very likely not. There are too many different people and different forms of meditation, and you're looking to get the right match.
And I wanted to remind people that if they live far away or have transportation problems, there are DVDs with Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga, probably even Whirling Dervishes. You know, there's probably DVD instruction that you can do in your home for probably fairly cheap. You know, the DVDs are probably less than $30. And, and you know, you basically, you can try them out and see how they work. But a moving meditation is often good because it's also a form of exercise, which is which is helpful.
And a DVD will often show you how to do it, and one would hope that you'd learn sufficiently from it not to have to put the DVD on every time. But and again, some people just don't learn that way. I have been all my life. I keep falling into this belief that if I buy tapes and CDs to listen to in the car, I will learn other languages that way. I don't want to say how much money I have, but I never can use them. I just am not the kind. And do I learn? No. Somebody comes along with, here is this new. I say, oh, I could, yeah, when I drive to work, I could be studying Gaelic, you know.
I want to tell you one thing you can't do in the car, because I did it. Drumming. I had a great drumming CD somebody gave me, and I put it on
car.
I was out of body in a minute. That is not a good idea. Of course, and the thing it says, do not listen to this while drumming me.
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a form of meditation found in many cultures that has really made a comeback in the last 15, 20 years. And there's been interesting studies done about the biological impact of drumming. One of the things that I find just stunning, makes my hair stand on end, is that in a drum circle, drummers, if they're in time, assuming they're drumming together, their hearts will begin to beat simultaneously. And
isn't
I just find that a stunning fact. They've done some research in use of drumming circles in Alzheimer's units and found that people's short-term memory improves for a time afterwards. So there's definitely something about that experience that is quite profound on a biological basis.
Well, you know, it probably has to do a lot with lymphatic drainage, too. You know, a lot of our sedentary lifestyle has, compared to what our ancestors had, you know, working on farms or, you know, having to walk places because we didn't have cars. A lot of our sedentary activity, just the lymphatic system doesn't get properly circulated.
Huh.
And I think drumming and other of the movement meditations can help that. But drumming, I think, does something to the, I don't know. I mean, I haven't read papers on what drumming does to the physiology, but it does something.
It does, it does. It's quite a profound, it has quite a profound impact. And it does seem to unite.
Well, sound does, yeah.
Yeah, but it does seem to unite mind and body in a quite amazing and important way.
It does, yeah.
Again,
and,
one
know,
of those things that, you know, has been known for millennia, you know, in traditional cultures.
That's what I was going to say. You know, if you, that's what I love to do is study all of the older cultures and see what was common. Dancing, drumming, and some form of sweat lodge, you know, where detoxification procedures were common in all sorts of different cultures all around the world, you know, the indigenous cultures. So that must have worked for, you know, for the health of the tribe.
One of my areas of academic research is the point at which folklore and science meet. And for the last several years, I've been studying the folklore of nettles. And it's very interesting. There's, you know, lots of folklore about how you're supposed to use nettles. And they're very specific. This is Irish folklore. Very specific at the time you're supposed to use them and how many times and so forth. So looking into the science of what's going on with the actual nettle plant at that time, at the time of emergence and pre-flowering, nettles are extremely filled with antioxidants. They're great blood purifiers. I mean, they really do have everything you need in the spring. So traditional wisdom had it that, you know, you're basically coming out of a cold, rainy winter indoors where no doubt people have a lot of immune problems and so forth. Immune support is very high with nettles in the spring.
Isn't that interesting?
And this traditional knowledge about, you know, eating them a certain number of times and eating them before they flower and so forth embeds some real scientific knowledge that is really very useful.
And what really fascinates me is how the shamans and the, you know, the indigenous medicine people would be guided to these. And actually, you know, they use these higher ability to get information from beyond what they knew to actually discover, kind of like Richard Bach did with the flower remedies. You know, it's it's in that altered state of consciousness you get this information. And then later on, you know, when our science advanced far enough, you can prove it scientifically. But isn't it great that they get the information from, you know, their spiritual practices? I mean, that's really what it is.
I think that there's a lot to be said for indigenous science, the knowledge of the plants around us and the and the way we interact with the plants and animals in our environment over the course of the seasons. Indigenous knowledge is not to be sniffed at. People managed to live on this earth pretty successfully for a long time. Not to say that there was not, you know, the problem of, you know, no good dental care, for example. We have better teeth now, but you know, do we have overall better health? And certainly, are we living sustainably on the earth? Well, I think we all know the answer to that. And, you know, I want to bring up, you know, as I mentioned that, taking from a Quaker perspective, one of the things that I think people often imagine as part of meditation is that by necessity, meditation gets you to be self-centered because mm-hmm. you're basically alone while you're doing it, you know, although you can be in a meditation group, but you're inside yourself. And I think there's a general perception that meditation is an entirely personal endeavor. But when you look at traditions like the Quaker tradition and a lot of other religiously based meditative traditions, they draw you back into connection with the world. The essence of Quaker worship is to sit in the silence, wait for messages, and then to enact them somehow in the world. So you don't come to realize that slavery is wrong, as you know occurred with early Quakers in America, and then just do nothing about it.
Right. Yeah.
you get to work.
Right.
And there's something quite profound about realizing that meditation is not a divorce from the outside world, but can engage you. But engage you not in a, I'm going to go fix everything, but in a really centered, I don't care how long it takes, we'll keep working on this, this is wrong, mm-hmm. we know it. And I think the Quaker vision of contemplation connecting with action is a real good model, you know, not to be too proud of my own faith, but
right.
it's a good model for realizing that meditation does not have to take you away from life. And that includes your family life, that includes your work life. You know, you're not necessarily engaging in just kind of a selfish, you know, I'm just getting away from you all. One would hope that in the greater peace that you find, you're able to engage in a more constructive way to make a better world.
Yeah, we've had a group meditation here since 1990. So
weekly.
Now we're meeting three times a week. There's been a greater need, and we were asked to meet three times a week. And we get information in meditation. I'll give you some examples. We were told about the stock market crash in mid-September 2008, at least 3 months before it happened. We were told about the flu. We were told that there would be a flu epidemic in late April, and that information came in at the beginning of April when the swine flu came in. Many of us are medical, so we ask, should we take the bird flu vaccine? Now, this was before the swine flu came in. And the answer was not necessarily, because Baxter has placed the bird flu in the vaccine. Well, about 3 weeks later, that came out in the news. I cannot emphasize, these are not things that we are making up. This is information from another source, a protective source, a source outside of the third dimension, period. And it's happened again and again and again. I gave you those three because they're very, you know, they're very dramatic things that we couldn't have made up. I mean, I couldn't have known that they were going to put the bird flu in the bird flu vaccine and then get discovered. You know, these are things that is protective. And that's what I tell people, you know, in this day and age, we are having massive changes in every segment of society. And if you don't want to feel like, you know, things are just going way too fast and way too dangerous, go and you know, start a meditation group with some of the people that you feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very protective. And, you know, it's always very loving and very, very good information. And frankly, that's what you need now. You need good protective information. Because the world we live in has got some threats that are new, stuff happening with the sun, energies coming in, changing the magnetosphere. On the 12th of March, the magnetosphere was changed for 30 hours, and it had health effects on people. We were told about that months before it ever happened. You know, just things that you need to know. Because you can prepare. I didn't lose any money when the stock market crashed in 08. In fact, I made money. My stockbroker commented that you're one of my few clients that made money. I said, yeah. Sold everything that I could, put my you know, retirement stuff in silver and gold, and I did very, you know, I did very well.
Good
but
for you.
You can take action, you know. And why not? Why not protect, you know, protect what you need to protect? So it's very practical, I think. That's what I'm trying to say. Meditation is very practical.
Yeah.
It can be very practical and very useful, especially now, I think.
It doesn't take you away from the world.
No, no. I mean, we get information about chemicals in the seafood from the Gulf, and to be careful to douse, you know, before you eat those seafood. You know, those are carcinogens, okay? You know, if an arsenic was used in the spraying of the, you know, that oil volcano they had down there, these are protective. These are very protective. There's radiation coming off of Japan people need to know about. You know, there's radiation showing up in the seafood, and especially the seaweed. So these are things that, you know, we hear them first in meditation. We hear them second on the Internet. You don't hear them in mainstream media. Forget that. So, you know, I consider it very protective. A little bit of radiation could go a long way to making your health very challenging, you know. So.
Indeed.
Yeah. So that's what I think. I think people
need to. Well, congratulations on keeping a group going for so long. That's quite impressive.
Well, thank you. It's part of my job here, and I have wonderful people in the group. I mean, we do it for service. It is for service, believe me. And but it's also serving ourselves, because whenever you give, you receive, and that's a spiritual law that you'll learn if you meditate, right? Well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give some of your contact information?
Well, this has flown so fast, I didn't even realize
it was
so close to the end. My website is patricia-monahan.com, M-O-N-A-G-H-A-N. That's the Irish language spelling. I was always told that the reason that we're Monahans were those really rich people from Massachusetts were Moynihans, is that the Moynihans couldn't spell their name when they arrived at Ellis Island. I don't know if that's true, but we have the correct spelling. And the book we've been talking about is Meditation, The Complete Guide, from New World Library, one of the most wonderful publishers I've ever had the pleasure to work with. It's just out in its new second edition, co-authored with Eleanor Virick.
And I just want to add that this is the most complete guide to meditation that I've ever seen. And I've had quite a few books on meditation, as you can imagine, doing this show once a week for, I think.
And if it can be a word, it got completer this time.
Right, completer.
We thought it was complete last time, but it got completer this time. One of the things that I was really pleased with was that we were able to find some traditional forms of Jewish meditation, which we had been unable to find in the first edition, although we'd looked and looked and looked. And the biggest difference between 1997 and 2011 is Google, because we did the first edition entirely through interlibrary loan and, you know, old-fashioned research and card catalogs type things. And
research was much more difficult.
Some things that were more elusive at the time are more available now. One problem is, of course, if you put in meditation in Google, you will get 20 gazillion hits, and where do you even start?
Right.
So we hope to give you some, you know, ways through the maze.
So whether you're just starting out and wanting to find what different meditative practices there are, or whether you're a very experienced meditator and want to understand more about the tradition, I would really recommend this book, Meditation, The Complete Guide, Techniques from East and West to Calm the Mind, Heal the Body, and Enrich the Spirit. Well, thanks, Patricia, for joining us. I really appreciate
you. Thank you so much. This has been perfectly delightful.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And may you have a fine rest of the day.
Oh, you too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next week on Temple of Health Radio Show, we will be interviewing Suzanne Taylor Shear, Soul Reunion, The Return Home from Separation. And on the 12th, Cindy Bentley, Celestial Being, How to Shift to Fifth Dimensional Living. On the 19th, Sandra Ann Taylor, The Hidden Power of Your Past Lives, Revealing Your Encoded Consciousness. And on the 26th, Michael Murray will be back with us with Why in the World Are They Spraying, regarding the chemtrails. The Noetic Science Meeting will be The Avalon Effect, presented by Dr. Brad Gould on the 17th, the third Thursday, 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. And the Millennium Healthcare event is Dr. Mike Greenberg will be giving a lecture on curing food allergies on the 22nd, also at 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.